Storming the last bastions of sanity, we are the marauders of truth on the pirate Vox Wave 665.66 UHMA Chemrat Radio. Coming to you live tonight from the very heart of rebellious mayhem, Misfit Alley.
And it's a good thing we're here too, Gabo. Might be a good time to stock up on weapons and ammo. As if the Underhive didn't have it hard enough, there might have been a new sighting reported of Harrowfrost Basilisk for the first time in nearly 100 years. And it sounds like the beast is having himself a good time, slaughtering and eating the Mechanicus work crew down in the Frost Hollow.
I heard all they found was a pile of bloody bones and gnawed plaz steel. I'm your Mohawk-crested, neon-splattered plasma fiend, Goblin King, joined today by my conspirator in conquest, the twin hand cannon gunslinger himself, Marky.
What's up, people? Me and Gobble holding it down this week.
Hell yeah.
Everyone else is dead. They're gone.
You're in Misfit Alley.
It's just me and Gabo. Last stand.
What do you mean? We're here. I mean, we're getting ramen at this place, and then maybe some baby back ribs over
this
there.
Is my last
and
stand.
Then
after I eat this stuff, I don't know if I'm gonna make it.
You know what we should do? We should do a cooking show of the Underhive. I'll pitch that
cooking show.
I'll pitch that to the Underhive Vox Network producers.
They're gonna be like, how many toilets, Marky?
I'm
gonna be like,
food show.
Like, I don't know, man. It was pretty solid. Give it a solid three toilets. So that's how many I'm gonna need after I finish this ramen.
Diners, drive bys, and dives.
Toilets are one time use, right?
Are we gonna catch a meal or are we gonna catch a bolt shell? I'm not sure. Welcome to episode 107, Horus Heresy, The Coming Storm, Part 4. Now, if you're new to the show, you're probably wondering why we keep saying episode 107 when it's our 154th release. And that's because we like to take a few different side quests from time to time outside of our main lore series, the main lore that we cover. While some episode formats like Planet Spotlight, Heroes of 40K, and our creative writing roundups end up with our main numbered sequence, Loris Obscurus is an example, and Under the Realms of Madness, our Warhammer Fantasy Battle and Age of Sigmar series don't. So when we do a Loris Obscurus gets their own number. Our next Loris Obscurus episode, I believe, will be episode either 15 or 16. And then Under the Realms of Madness is in the same boat because we're talking about fantasy lore, we're talking about Age of Sigmar lore. We number those. We started again at one, and we're just kind of working up. And then we've played around with some other stuff. We had Tales from the Hive for a while, which we didn't necessarily abandon. We still really like your guys' lore. You guys just don't send it to us that much. So if you want us to go through some of your lore, you have to make sure that you email it to us. You got to email those lore stories in. You can do that at underthehiveofmadness@gmail.com.
Yeah, and if you feel like... Well, why don't you come up with your own fucking lore there, host guy, podcast guy that's yelling at me right now to do something? We have. So feel free to check out our old episodes and check out all our own personalized custom lore that we came up with if you want to listen to that.
And we'll have episodes in the future. We definitely have more lore stuff that we'll bring you. But all that stuff, the point is, most of that stuff ends up outside of our numbered episodes. Because our aim is always to look at the hobby and lore from the perspective of telling collaborative narrative stories. That's why we cover the official lore in such detail, as well as diving into the factions and subfactions, all in order to provide a sort of like bedrock-based knowledge to the setting. We want to establish everything we can. We want to splash some water on your feet, get you guys interested. If you want to check out anything deeper in the series that we do, 100% jump in. But the entire reason we're doing it at the end of the day is to give you guys kind of a more empowered place to start telling your own story in the Warhammer 40K universe or the Warhammer Old World universe. We're starting to do that too.
Just want to get your panties wet for the 40K lore universe.
And then, of course, with the Loris Obscurus series, we're looking at the folklore of the real world. The weird things, the spooky things, the stuff that we experience as modern day people that live in the real world. It feels so weird because 40K definitely, it like takes place in our future.
For
like,
lack of better
our
words,
future.
The real world.
So, yeah.
IRL.
What was the fucking real world thing?
Wasn't that a show? Real world?
It was. And they always said something like,
yeah, like Drake on
find
it
out
shit.
What happens when people stop being polite and start being real. And you'd be like, all right, edgelord, like yeah. Chill fuck out there, buddy.
Real fake.
A real scripted by somebody else. But the way that we kind of bring up the Loris Obscurus stuff, the way that we've the way that we've tailored Loris Obscurus as we played around the format is we bring up something in real world folklore, whether or not it's a cryptid, whether or not it's a ghost sighting, whether or not it's a UFO phenomenon, anything like that. And then we kind of tailor it to talk about how that sort of stuff, these sorts of like cryptid stories or these sorts of things that you may have heard, all can be inspiration points to either jump into short narrative elements in the 40K universe or to even write short stories. And we pick a spooky topic, generally speaking, and then we use it to write what we call a short Ordo Obscurus report. And these are presented very much in the same style as the SCP Foundation, if you're familiar with that. We've got a way that Ordo Obscurus reports are written, and then we present that to you guys. We give you that grounding immediately in the Warhammer 40K universe, and then we immediately turn over to how that lore works in our own sector, the Carcosan sector, which is our kind of like podcast homebrew lore area. And then we use the lens of whatever we talked about to talk about whatever the real world topic was. We go over the details of the real world topic, and then we share some of our opinions and ideas on how you can use it in your own lore development, whether or not that's for 40K or whatever you want to do. We want you guys to be part of that. And the way that you listeners can be a part of that, we'll go into more details at the end of the show, but I will warn you, it does deal with typing up stuff and emailing it to us. So if you're allergic to that, you're going to hear it anyway. But this episode specifically, and the reason I brought all this stuff up, is this episode will conclude our coverage of the early years of the Horus Heresy. And we'll be taking a break for a few episodes to cover some of these side content misadventures, side quests. That's what they're called in video games, right? We'll be taking a couple of episodes to cover some of our side quests. It helps us basically kind of reset and address the next series that we're going to write, come up with. We've got the roadmap. We know what we're going to do, but we also need to like actually break down and figure out, how many episodes do we want it to span? Do we want to try to get rid of? Is there stuff we want to pare down? Is there stuff we want to get deeper into? Obviously, as you guys experienced with the first set of Horus Heresy stuff, we very much decided that we were going to cover three battles in great detail before we went ahead and went through the early years. And we did that on purpose because we felt that those three battles were really, really important. And we're basically going to take the next chunk of our research, we're going to make sure we're happy with it, and then we're going to kind of tailor it and write those episodes, write that series right for you guys. And these episodes in between kind of help us like reset. It's the same idea, you know, we've talked about in the hobby process before. If you're getting a little bit burned out painting your Space Marine army, take a minute to paint a Seraphon from Age of Sigmar, or take a minute to paint a dwarf. Yeah, just something that kind of regrounds you, resets you. And we do the same with our writing. With that in mind, we have an Under the Realms of Madness episode focused on Marathi coming your way, as well as another creative writing episode, and, as I teased out, another Loris Obscurus. But we will be continuing after that our coverage of the Horus Heresy with another multi-part series, which will be on its way in just a couple of weeks.
Under the Balls of Madness.
Under the Balls of, is that going to be when we get to Manscaped?
Yeah, whenever we get sponsored by Manscaped, Under the Balls of Madness. Are your balls mad? Shave them down with this new, with the Manscaped 5000 fucking bushwhacker.
But whatever the Manscaped 40K is going to be.
Yeah, 40K edition Manscaped, the bushwhacker 40,000. The
Angron Pathfinder.
Yeah, it's got an angry marine on the end of it.
So last episode, we wrapped up with the Battle of Ravendelve, where Omegon, Alpharius's twin and second of the Alpha Legion's Primarchs, stole an artifact from Corvus Korax. This artifact was one that allowed for the creation of the Raptors, a variant of the Space Marine Gene Seed template. And while they had done all of this work for Horus, the Alpha Legion passed on a fake replica to the Warmaster, keeping the real one for their own nefarious purposes. Now our story actually shifts completely back to the War Master and the battlefields he has a little bit more direct control over.
Now, Raptors being like the chapter, the Space Marine Raptors chapter, not Raptors like the jump.
No, remember the unit, the Jump Raptors?
Oh, not a chapter?
No, it's the unit. That's like it's you can take them.
The Chaos Space Marines?
I think they're Chaos only now, but yeah.
Okay, yeah, okay. So it is
the Jump
it,
Troops.
It is the unit, the Raptors. Yep. Okay. I thought we were referring to the chapter.
The chapter itself. Maybe. I think we'll get into it. We're going to circle back around. We're going to talk about the Cabal. We're obviously going to talk about the Raven Guard in more detail. And we'll talk a little bit more about how the Raven Guard was going to rebuild itself and all of that when we cover them as a chapter Legion Primarch when we get to our Primarch series. So we'll definitely have more detail on it. But
I thought I was tripping out for a second. So the Raptors chapter is like they're green with the white eagle on their pauldron. Then there's the unit, the Raptors, the Chaos Raptors, the Jump Pack Marines, Assault Marines, essentially, right?
Yeah, I think the Chapter Raptors is a successor of the Ultramarines.
Yeah, I believe. Yeah, that's why I was kind of getting confused last episode. Gotcha. I was like, are we talking about the Chapter of the Raptors? Or are we talking about, like, the Chaos Raptors, Jump Assault Marines? So we're talking about the Jump guys.
Yeah, we're talking to a variant of the Space Marine Gene Seed that allowed for better Jump Troops, which at this point,
Lighter hollow bones.
Yeah, and there's a reason they're all chaos, and we'll get there. We'll get there.
They had longer legs, stockier necks, bigger balls.
Those are the kinds of things you need bounce. To be a jump marine.
Wait, what?
It helps you with that bounce.
Oh.
It's like a yoga ball, right? You just got a pair of yoga balls between
you. You said they had a big mouth. I was like, whoa.
I mean, they're space marines. They don't. Anyway. What are you going to do when you're on the battle barge with all your brothers?
Yeah, right. It gets real lonely.
The battle for the Cornid Deeps and the Manchean War 007.M31. So the Cornid Deeps, formerly referred to as the Cornid Thule, is a region of Imperial space that encompasses the frontier border areas of Segmentum Obscurus and Segmentum Ultima. This was also some of the most industrialized regions of the Northern Imperium in the early 31st millennium. As a brief refresher on the map, if you take the Milky Way and view it from above the elliptical, so you're looking down at the map, it becomes flat. And then we're going to place Earth or Terra a bit off center to the left, but kind of in the center, top down, center, left, right, off to the left. And around that, you're going to put the Segmentum Solar. Segmentum Solar and Segmentum Pacificus are kind of like the same size. The Segmentum Solar definitely feels like one of the smaller ones. And then as I just brought up, to the galactic west is the Segmentum Pacificus, which is the smallest one by area. And it's just really tall and skinny. It basically borders the Segmentum Solar on the west side. It's not very thick. And, you know, if you look at a map of the Milky Way galaxy and you look at where Earth is located, we're located on one of the outer spiral arms. The Segmentum Pacificus is essentially that area outside of that spiral arm, if you want to say.
Yeah, I was going to say it looks like a Simon Says toy.
Yes,
like,
good comparison.
The one portion of it is like times four the size of the other buttons.
Right. So to the galactic north is the Segmentum Obscurus, and to the south is the Segmentum Tempestus. And these are both roughly the same size, and they kind of look like pie pieces if you cut the center out. So if you cut the pie unequally, as Marky just said, and then you took a cup and you cut out the center, that's what these kind of look like. So the galactic east is the Segmentum Ultima, which is absolutely fucking huge. It is roughly the size of all other segmentums if you looked at total area. So if you take the total area of all the others and then you apply it, Segmentum Ultima is that big, essentially. It's massive. We will post a link to a map. If you guys have never seen it, it's actually the map. If you join us for 3, 6, or 9. Where did I get 5? If you join us for $3, $6, or $9 on Patreon, you can see a video version of the podcast where we bring up some photos, and I've got the photo up right now. But we'll still post a link so you guys can pull it up, look at it at your leisure. Now, much closer to the 41st millennium, the Cornid Deeps region would be incorporated into the Imperial Gothic sector. The Gothic sector is galactically northeast of Terra. and it borders the region where the Solar, Obscurus, and Ultima Segmentums all touch. It's basically just east of the Eye of Terror. The Coronid Deeps region stretches back to the Dark Age of Technology, when mankind first spread beyond Sol System. Many worlds in the various regions that make up the Coronid Deeps were settled at this early time. The human settlers terraforming and transforming the worlds that they found into habitable ones, and then later into industrious centers of human civilization. When the massive warp storms that cut the galaxy apart during the Age of Strife came up, this region was cut off from the rest of humanity for thousands of Terran years, each world forced to fend for itself and to survive the horrors of Old Night.
This looks like a big galaxy with a bunch of stretch marks on it.
I mean, yeah, it's essentially... So the image specifically that we're going to share is a legitimate picture of the Milky Way galaxy, or, well, a legitimate depiction of what we think the Milky Way galaxy looks like, because I don't think we've sent anything far enough away to take this picture.
To see the full picture.
But yeah, that picture, if you look up the Milky Way galaxy, or if you know what it looks like kind of in your head, it's that picture, and then somebody put the Cicadrix Maledictum map on top of it, and then somebody put the old Segmenta map on top of that. And then they put a bunch of planets on it. It's a really cool map. But I don't know. Can you see my pointer right now, Marky? For the viewers? So this is where the Gothic sector is, basically. So here's Segmentum Obscurus. Here's Ultima. Here's Sol, or Segmentum Solar. So this little like area where Segmentum Solar notches up, it's where like Fenris and Armageddon and a couple of other worlds are. It's that area where it touches. This is essentially the Gothic sector. And then the Eye of Terror is right here. If my laser pointer is working for this PowerPoint presentation. Before the Great Crusade retook the area, much of the Coronid Deep suffered under the inhuman overlordship of the Mitu conglomerate. Maybe it's not Mitu. Maybe it's Mitu. The Mitu conglomerate. The conglomerate was a cabal of several psychically empowered pseudo-Atrianic xenospecies believed to have evolved from a common ancestor species. They looked a lot like sea anemones of ancient Terra, but with legs. They were overall mostly bisymmetrical, although their tentacled heads were an abstract form and often misshapen. There's not a lot of pictures of these guys. There's actually not even a lot of descriptions of these guys. And that happens a lot in Warhammer 40K lore. They bring up a name, they give you a couple of details, and then they move on because it's a hideous xeno species that was wiped off the map. The Mitu conglomerate were warp capable and possessed advanced biological and arcane technologies, which they used to forge a pocket interstellar empire, forbidding any attempts at space flight among their subjugated worlds and ruthlessly purging any psychers found within their domains. They also periodically demanded a culling of their subjugated human populations, and it's believed that this tribute of flesh provided them with the basic components that they used to construct their technology. Just kind of fucking horrifying. Like, hey, we're going to kill everybody on this planet because we need new cell phones.
That's very weird. Almost like some Rick and Morty shit, right? Yeah, like a cell phone that's made out of like human skin. It's got like teeth and an eyeball in it.
Right. Early in the 9th century of the 30th millennia, the Imperial Expeditionary Fleet of the Great Crusade came into contact with the remnant human civilization in the Coronid Deeps. This region was entirely uncharted to any pre-Imperial records and was locked under the conglomerate's control, and the Imperium's response to these Xenos overlords was total annihilation. The war that followed was protracted and extremely bloody, eventually requiring the intervention of several expeditionary fleets. Fought largely in the void in a series of brutal close quarters boarding engagements, when combat did reach planet side, the results were apocalyptic, with each requiring no fewer than 3 Space Marine legions and hundreds of Solar Auxilia cohorts. The liberation of these star systems was a turning point for humanity, and for those who lived for so long under the oppression of inhuman intelligences and the constant threat of death. The Imperial compliance was accepted with open arms, and much of the region was organized under the ruler of an Imperial commander or the custodianship of the Mechanicum. The Coronid Deeps became a highly productive and vital strategic region of the Imperium during the later years of the Great Crusade, becoming a shining beacon of Imperial civilization moving forward. But this is one of those places where the amount of industrial production that was available just completely changed the speed at which they could export, essentially.
Does it talk about like how these Xenos fought? Because it sounds like they gave them a hard time. So I'm kind of curious if they kind of spoke on the battles and how they actually fought, because they look like they're almost like a Psyker species.
They were a Psyker species. So they had some really crazy technology, and they also used like warrior forms, and their technology essentially was biomechanical. So
it's almost like Protoss.
A little bit. It almost kind of reminds me of like true body horror too. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Existence.
No.
It was like one of those movies that came out right around the time of The Matrix, and everybody was like, oh, this movie's copying The Matrix. But then if you watch it, it's nothing like The Matrix.
Yeah.
But in Existence, the main character at one point eats a rotisserie chicken to get like the components to build a handgun. And he literally builds it out of disgusting like meat slobbered chicken parts.
That's gnarly. I don't know, man. It's because like in StarCraft, like the Protoss, they have like it kind of reminds me of like the Dragoons, right? So like the Dragoons, they're almost like a biomech, where it's like they seem like they have like their fleshy parts, and like they're sitting inside of a sack. I mean, unless I'm remembering Dragoons wrong, but it seems
No, you're picturing them right. So these things are depicted in the pictures that we do have of them. They're depicted a lot like sea anemones, except instead of having that like one stalk that goes down to the coral, they've got like three or four of them. And I guess each member of the species, or each subspecies in the conglomerate, it was obvious that they were all at one point. It'd be like if you came across humans, Ogryns, halflings, and like an elf, not an Eldari, but an elf, all living in a certain area. And you're like, oh, these are obviously all different now, but they're obviously all, and dwarves, but they're obviously all from the same stock. They all look human. You can tell they all kind of look like the same species. So I think it's more like that. But, you know, they look like sea anemones. And then they've got, instead of that one suction foot that goes down and holds onto the coral, they've got multiples. However, as you look at each of their different like constructs that they use to fight, it almost kind of looks like they turned humans into weapons. But instead of like the way that the Mechanicus does it, where they like replace, oh, you're going to have a toaster arm now, buddy. They're like, no, we're just going to take all of your bones and we're going to turn them into blades that are on the outside of your body now. And then we're going to encase you in that dude's skeleton. So we're going to sacrifice Bob. Bob is now your armor.
That's so gnarly, dude, because it's like, what would you use as a projectile? Like, what?
Teeth.
Yeah, that's the first thing that comes to mind, right? That's what came to mind to me. It was literally, like teeth, yeah. But like, what is the propulsion system? Like, fucking gas?
Muscle contraction? Almost, I mean, it's like kind of like, if you think about the Tyranids, that's the way that a lot of the Tyranid weapons work. You think of like a mantis shrimp, you know, a mantis shrimp can like punch super fast or whatever. So yeah, it's all that muscle interaction. And if our brains... if the human brain didn't introduce pain and hold you back, you could actually, your muscles could break your bone. Like, it's pretty gnarly what muscle contraction and like electrical impulses can do. But I don't know. This is one of those races that is interesting, and I want to know more. Yeah, you can definitely, they were made to be big boogeymen. You can definitely see why they were all fucking wiped out. But at the same time, it's such a crazy fucking idea. You want to know more. You know what I mean? And like looking at the warrior form picture that we can find, which is just some artist's depiction from reading the book, it looks gnarly as fuck, dude. It looks like this crazy like wood bone biomechanical spider thing on like a snake body. I don't even know if I'm describing it right.
I don't even... looks like a squid with arms.
Yeah. It looks like a squid with... that's a good... yeah. A squid with blade arms, basically. Yeah,
like arachnid arms.
You get the impending doom, I guess, or the impending strength of them based on the fact that when the Imperium had to take a planet, three legions of Space Marines showed up. Like, and that's a lot of Space Marines. Yeah. And that's what it took to wrest the planet from them. It just makes you... but yeah, they killed them all. They're all dead.
Yeah, it's almost like an early Dark Eldar-esque kind of body horror. Instead of being made into a couch, you're being made into a gun, some armor.
Right, right.
Turning your wiener into an umbrella or something. I don't know. It's got some utility. This member has some utility. I don't know.
There's a power in Vampire the Masquerade called Vicissitude, which essentially allows you to like use magic to craft flesh into other things.
Oh, Jesus.
And I remember at one point somebody making a character where like the concept, or maybe getting their character to the level.
Oh.
But for whatever reason, they made like an elder of one of the vampire clans that was powerful enough that the way that they like played was they turned their human slaves into like furniture.
Yeah.
And you didn't die. So now you're a lawn chair.
I was going to say, this actually reminded me of one of my daughter's favorite animes is Parasite. Have you ever seen that?
No. Do people Parasite? Get made into furniture?
No, but like essentially it's these alien parasites that draw, and forgive me if I fucking butcher this, I'm a horrible storyteller. These parasites dropped in from space, and essentially what they do is like they burrow into your body and they take over your brain and your body. And they essentially like, I think they're doing it to like eat people or something like that. But essentially what happens is this parasite like burrows into this guy's arm and he catches it and he stops it almost like a Evil Dead. And so instead of taking over
just his arm or whatever.
Yeah. So instead of burrowing into his brain, it'll die if it doesn't, you know, stay in his body. It burrows, it takes over his hand. So his hand just becomes like this crazy thing that can like morph and whatnot. So essentially kind of like what you were saying, like it turns like their, what he does with his hand is what the other ones will do with the, like their face. Like they'll turn their face into like a bunch of whips or like a huge sword or shit like that.
Got you. It makes me think of the Bio Titan from Resident Evil.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy. This parasite dude's thumb is a blade, one of his fingers is an eyeball, and then he has a mouth in the middle of his hand, which I imagine talks to the guy, and like that would just drive me fucking nuts. Why is my hand talking to me?
Yeah, and he like does, sleep he here, can't, buddy. Can't control his arm, like shit like that. It's like the parasite was like, while he was sleeping, the parasite would like stretch his arm out and be on his laptop, like learning about the human civilization and shit. It was a trippy anime.
That's pretty funny.
It's good,
that's
though.
Pretty cool.
There's like a dog, like a parasite got inside of a dog, and it like turned into like this flying fucking bat thing that was attacking him. It was pretty gnarly.
That's crazy. Yeah, I imagine there's a little bit of that going on with these things. Like they can just kind of do whatever the fuck they want with your shape based on biotechnology. The other thing that it could be is like, think of like the Obliterator virus.
Oh, yeah. That's a good thing too.
A little bit. Yeah. So as warp turbulence once again began to rise, the closer to the Battle of Kalth and the coming of the Runestorm approached, this region would once again become cut off from the Segmentum Solar. What would become known as the Manchean War was a campaign carried under the direct command of the Warmaster Horus during the latter part of 007.M31, starting sometime just before the Battle of Kalth. It was an early example of the Warmaster's new tactic of turning his force to seize entire sectors of the Imperium, targeting those that he deemed valuable. So he would essentially ignore certain sectors, certain subsectors, and then he would just overwhelmingly invade something that had massive strategic value, while also becoming a demonstration of the speed and brutality with which such campaigns could be executed. It also provided a valuable template for scores of campaigns that were to follow, both in the terms of strategy and the savage consequences for those worlds which fell to the traitors throughout the Horus Heresy. The conquest of Manchia was led personally by Horus and his inner cadre of commanders, and would become the centerpiece of several linked campaigns, fleet actions, and local wars, which swallowed the celestial region known as the Cornid Deeps. Manchia itself was the jewel of the region, a highly populated and advanced hive world, which sat at the center of its own well-developed subdomain of attendant star systems called the Manchean Commonwealth. Its value to the Warmaster was measured not only by its strategic control over the region, but by its vast human and industrial resource, which could be exploited and turned towards the traitors' war efforts. Nearby sectors also included the mineral-rich Cyclops Cluster, home to two fully-fledged Mechanicum Forge Worlds, the Armada Imperialis fleet anchorage of Port Maw, and several independent Night Worlds, plus a score of Agri Worlds and other colonies which could be used to feed and supply Horus's armies for the long march towards Terra. However, the area was far from unguarded, and although the traitor's agents had already been at work in the region, the bulk of its worlds and military strength was already set against them. The region's imperial commanders, alerted by the mass blasts of warnings which had spread from the news of Istvan III atrocity after it had reached Terra. The Coronid Deeps got the message first over others because of how close they were to the Istvan system and because of how valuable they were.
When they were taken over, or when this like whole Manchia war was going on, was this happening as Horus was marching towards Terra after all these battles like Istvan and all the other battles? Or
he left from Istvan 5 and went to the Coronid Deeps. Okay. That was Horus's next target. Horus knew that he had to felt that he had to take this region
in order to
the resources that were there, right, and the stuff that it would allow him to move towards Terra. So the weirdly deceptive thing is that all of this stuff, Istvan, the Coronid Deeps, a lot of this stuff we've talked about is actually relatively close to Terra. It's really not that far away. I mean, let me take that back. It's really close to the Segmentum Solar. So, you know, by proximity, it's not like he's almost in the Ghoul Stars, yeah, and then he's coming all the way in from the edge of the galaxy. He's starting really, really close to the edge of Segmentum Solar. However, that's the area that is the densest with populated worlds.
So it almost works as like a forward operating base for him.
Yeah.
With all the resources and whatnot. Okay.
Right, right. So Port Maw itself had been used as a layover and resupply base for a number of the fleets that had been dispatched so disastrously to punish the traitors at Istvan 5. The fleets that had left to go to Istvan 5 stopped at Port Maw to be resupplied and to do whatever their layover, you know, here's your couple of days not on the ship, here's your couple of days to get last supplies before jumping to Istvan 5. And those fleets obviously met with disaster. The vast majority of Imperial garrison forces in the Coronid Deeps were that of the Imperialis Armada and regiments of the Solar Auxilia patterned Exratus Imperial Army formations. The Solar Auxilia pattern was particularly suited to the defense of the region as it was equipped and formed to fight in hostile environments and to participate in void battles. So these guys were there because this is their kit and caboodle. Conditions that were common across this entire region. While the high technology base of worlds like Manchia and Agathon were well suited to meet their requirements, something that wasn't always possible on the majority of Imperial colony worlds. So the Coronid Deeps get these guys because the Coronid Deeps, a lot like Terra and the Satrine Polates, is set to support them. One. Two, it's a type of fighting that you're going to do here. It's not, you know, a bunch of planets that have good conditions for a Stardace and humans to fight on. It's a bunch of fucking lifeless rocks and voids that have to be combated over. These defenders proved themselves able to withstand Xenos raiders, rebel uprisings, and occasionally full-on invasions, even if only that was until reinforcements arrived from other areas. They were well provided with arms and warships and numbered in the hundreds of thousands in terms of active troops. However, they had never been measured against the unthinkable, the Imperium's own Space Marine Legions.
So they got bent over backwards.
They're about to be.
So the,
it's about to go down.
The three legions that took on the Sian enemy people, those were traitor legions.
The Coronid Deeps. That happened.
Okay, that happened before they. Okay, gotcha.
That was during the compliance of the Great Crusade.
Yeah. Okay.
And it wasn't necessarily the same three legions. The way that it's described really nebulously. It's one of those.
It was three legions, quote unquote, what it consisted of. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So we don't really know. It was multiple expeditionary fleets, the planet being, you know, planetary actions usually requiring up to three Space Marine legions. So it could have been Blood Angels, Alpha Legion, and Sons of Horus, or it could have been Thousand Suns, Space Wolves, and
three legions. I got you. Yeah. Okay.
When in late 006.M31, terrifying reports of the drop site massacre at Istvan 5 reached the governing courts and councils of the Coronid Deeps, they were first scoffed at and treated as false reports. But then the first few loyalist survivors and their battered ships, those who had escaped the void battle at Istvan, began to limp in sinking sanctuary. For the Hounds of Horus never abated, and they were at their backs. Fear then gripped Manchia, Agathon, Mazoa, and 100 other worlds greater and lesser along the frontier. Requests for aid and instructions from Terra were lost in the blinding squalls of warp static. With the warp storms at their backs and the black void of the frontier laid out before them, the worlds of the Coronid Deeps could do little but wait for the devil they knew approached. By 008.M31, the Coronid Deeps, once a stable outpost of the Imperium, had become a fractured series of traitor-ruled domains in a wider galaxy that was sundered by war. But they were soon to be challenged as a counter-invasion of Numila and the catastrophic destruction visited upon Gethsemane would only be the start to the new phase in an ongoing war for the Coronid Deeps. The traitors take all this stuff, and then there's a counter invasion on Numenal. Where did I get Numelia? Numenal. And then the entire planet Gethsemane is destroyed. And that's done by the loyalists. And that starts essentially the back and forth, which grips this area for years. This area became steeped in another protracted and bloody series of campaigns and battles with no certain victor. Outposts were raided, planets laid to waste, and convoys ambushed as murderous reprisal was taken by each side. The tables frequently turned and the hunters would become the hunted, just for it to whip back and again. Whenever one side gained an advantage, it was quickly squandered or laid low by sudden reversal of somebody's fortunes. Loyalists and traitors clashed again and again as the tides of unquieted warp allowed reinforcements for new battle groups in, as the battles waxed high and then waned into bloody exhaustion, only to be taken up once more. So the way that I kind of figure this means is the tides would turn in favor of the traitors because the traitors could use secret passages in the warp. And then the wars would basically like grind down into stagnation with the traitors kind of ruling. But even though the Chaos Gods are in support of the traitors, all of the Chaos Gods, especially Khorne, are fed by battle. So then the Chaos Gods are like, well, fuck it. Nothing's happening here anymore. Let's let a bunch of loyalists in. The loyalists would come rushing back in and the entire cycle would start again. And on, you know, the War Master's side, that's good because you're just constantly grinding your foe little by little against your troops.
Okay. So this is all just like humans, though. This isn't like loyalist space marines. This is all traitors, traitor marines.
This is everything. This entire area is swallowed by space marine legions and humans fighting each other.
Sounds like a good time.
Right? During these conflicts, the Coronid Deeps would become a grim template for an age of war, an age born on Istvan III, but which would outlast the heresy, the great scouring which followed it, and extend well into the Age of Darkness that was fast approaching. The Coronid Deeps are the template for, in the grim darkness of the far future, there is only war. Like half of the other battles we've read.
A lot of shit happened there.
Yeah. But it kind of does paint this picture of like the Coronid Deeps during the early part of the 31st millennia was a prediction of what the 41st millennia would look like. It would just be this endless struggle between chaos in the Imperium,
back and forth
with, yeah, you know, the Xenos throwing a monkey wrench in whatever the fuck they want to do. And they do talk about that. They talk about the fact that there are like Xenos shit that happens during this time too. It's not as big, it's not as impactful, but you know, like every once in a while, the orcs are going to just be like, oh, there's a fight. Let's go.
Don't mind if I do.
And you know, the Dark Eldar, which have started to kind of be around at this point. You know, the Dark Eldar just started forging their empire at this point. So this is going to be when they're taking the majority of their slaves. They're probably popping into these big war zones and taking advantage of the chaos to steal people.
Yeah, so that was always my point of contention with 30K, was that
they don't talk about the Xenos stuff enough.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of Xenos. It's a lot of Marine on Marine action, and that's just, doesn't tickle my fancy.
It gets really samey really quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
We feel it's cool the way that we're going over it, because most of these little tidbits that we're talking about are books. Exactly. And sometimes more than one.
And when it's a book of the Sparks same notes. Stoic, sometimes snarky space marine, it's a little old. You know, variety is the spice of life, as they say.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
When you have and I don't mean a variety of the same thing, right? A Twinkie that's yellow and a Twinkie that's blue still tastes like a Twinkie.
Marky asked for variation and I painted two different ones and now he's complaining. I see how it is.
Yeah.
My life is an artist. No. That'll bring us up to the Battle of Kalth in 007.M31. We covered the Battle of Kalth already in a three-part series earlier in season 3. Yeah, actually, just a couple of weeks back. But to give a better idea of where it fits into this entire timeline, the conflicts in the Coronid Deeps would start in late 006.M31 and really heat up in early 007.M31. Basically, Horus launched his major attack on Manchia, probably within a few days to a few weeks before the Battle of Kalth would start. So that anchors it in time. That's why, even though the Coronid Deeps last past the Battle of Kalth, why it gets introduced in the timeline before the Battle of Kalth. The Horus Heresy definitely always works to reinforce the idea that historical events don't happen in a vacuum and nothing is a neat literal timeline. There is no thing A happens, then thing B happens. It's thing A is happening, thing X starts, oh shit, thing C, wait, what about B? Shit, we left out S. Hey guys, go back to 01. You're like, whoa. In fact, a major goal of Erebus on Kalth was the ritual which would bring about the Ruinstorm, and the Ruinstorm itself would work to mitigate any of the Loyalists' early coordinated counter-assaults in the Coronid Deeps. We just talked about that. The whole idea that it may have been Chaos getting bored that let the Loyalists in again so the cycle could start again would be the Chaos God suppressing the Ruinstorm long enough for messages to get out and reinforcements to arrive. Not to mention the wider impact it would have across the galaxy itself. Keep in mind that the Heresy is a 9-year conflict, kicking off with the Ishtvan III atrocity in 005.M31. The coming of the Ruinstorm acts as sort of a conclusion to the first third of the conflict, as the repercussions of the ritual define the next set of conflicts that we'll get into in our next series moving forward.
So this is all happening. This is all happening.
Kind of overlapping each other.
Yeah, overlapping each other, but not all within this zone, right? The Coronid Deeps.
Yeah. So the Coronid Deeps is one region of space, and Kalth is it. The Coronid Deeps are essentially in the Gothic sector.
Yeah.
And Kalth is essentially way, way over in the realm of Ultramar. So they're separated by hundreds of thousands of light years, essentially. Yeah. And like at the same time, the Cygnus cluster stuff that we talked about two episodes ago with Sanguinius, right, is, you know, again, that started before this started, but that continued for like a year. So even though it started in 006, it doesn't end until 007. So the Cygnus cluster stuff is starting to end right around the time that this stuff is starting. All of this stuff, which is separated by hundreds of thousands of light years, is essentially happening at the same time. But because we have the warp and faster than light travel, a lot, you know,
you miss some of
that scale because you can kind of quickly get around the map.
Right.
Fast travel definitely changes the game a little bit, so to speak. And the Ruinstorm takes away fast travel, essentially.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the Ruinstorm splits the galaxy, and this is during and after the Battle of Kalth. So this is an event, this major linchpin in the Horus Heresy. Like I said, it kind of ends the first third of the Heresy. The first 3 years really wrap up with this event. It happens during the Battle of Kalth. The Ruinstorm was a massive warp storm engineered by Logar, Primarch of the Word Bearers, which divided up the Milky Way galaxy. It disrupted interstellar travel and communications during the Heresy, hindering cooperative communication and coordinated defenses by the Loyalists across the Imperium of Man, while it further isolated Terra from those same Loyalist forces. At the same time, at least in theory, if not always in practice, the traitor forces aligned with Chaos would be able to use secret passages through the storm to move a lot more freely. Chaos isn't necessarily hampering the traitors this way. They're not always giving the traitors what they want because it's still Chaos. They'll still fuck with you. But the traitors are able to move quite a bit more coordinated and communicate a little bit more. Basically, the traitors have the upper hand in all of this because of Chaos, but Chaos is still fucking with them. To be clear, while there is a very real moment when the Ruined Storm comes fully into existence, just like the lead up to the birth of Slaanesh, the warp had already started to shift and act up. And that's what we've covered, a lot of stuff where we keep saying these warp storms started and they get worse to the Ruined Storm. We've said that kind of a couple of times over the last two episodes, and that's because all of these, the ritual of the warp storm, all of the energy that's building towards the actual ritual, all of those ripples start, all of those birth pangs, those contractions start in the warp earlier. And that stuff is happening because of the massive death at Istvan 3, the massive death at Istvan 5. These massive psychic releases and deaths of Astartes and humans, it's a huge ripple into the Immaterium. It's already causing all of this kind of building of water behind the dam that's weakening. There's always cracks and trickles of water that come out of the dam before it bursts. And that a lot of that's already happening before the Ruined Storm happens. The Ruined Storm is the dam collapsing and all of the water rushing down to destroy everything, I guess, if that makes sense. It would fall to Erebus, first chaplain of the Word Bearers, to pull the ritual that would create the Ruined Storm in full during the Battle of Kalth. The battle itself came about when Horus ordered the Ultramarines and Word Bearers to muster at the planet in the Viridian system before the cat was out of the bag. Turbulence in the warp had already acted to keep news of the Istvan system from reaching the Ultramarines, who still believed everything was business as usual when it came to the ongoing Great Crusade. The Ultramarines had no idea that the Word Bearers were bad guys. They had no idea that Horus was a bad guy. They were mustered at Kalth, and then no communication got to them. And they didn't necessarily think that was weird, because the warp acting up was the thing that had happened during the entire Great Crusade. So there's no reason to worry until there's every reason to worry, essentially. But the Word Bearers were the first traitors, even predating Horus's own corruption of the Battle of Davin, and their orders from the War Master were twofold. Destroy their old nemesis legion, the Ultramarines, while executing Logar's plan to bring about the Ruined Storm, which required, in part, the destruction of the Viridian Star as part of the offering to the Ruinous Powers. The Powers need these massive influxes of energy. Massive death, massive energy. You know, the way to look at the warp, and I think we talked about this before, but the way to look at the warp is that any human emotion is essentially magnified on the surface of the Immaterium. The warp and the Immaterium being interchangeable words. So love is magnified there. Hate is magnified there. Lust is magnified there. At the same time, a human life ending, any life ending, an Eldari life, a Krut life, a Tau, well, not a Tau life. Tau don't count. but any life, you're muted.
Are you trying to say that the Tau are the gingers of 40K? Is that what you're telling me right now?
The lore says the Tau are the gingers of 40K. I didn't say shit. But any living creature essentially has a resonance level in the warp. Humans and Eldari resonate the loudest, essentially. Eldari resonate more than humans. But Eldari just got pretty heavily fucked. And really not that long ago, the birth of Slaanesh was like M30. So this is M31. We're only talking about 1,000 years. In the time scale of Warhammer 40K, it's not that much time.
No.
So a human dying resonates in the warp. Hundreds of thousands of humans dying resonates 100,000 times more. An entire planet being stripped of life because the sun goes nova, even more. An entire star system of life, habitable space stations, slightly terraformed planets, maybe other habitable planets being stripped of life with a nova, even more. Each of these things, not only are they sacrificing the power of the star, because the star itself also reflects in the warp. It just doesn't necessarily reflect in the warp as like a living entity, but it still has a power signature. And suns are massive. So even if the sun only magnifies 0.5% in the warp, it's still well more power than a single human. So you've got all of this stuff stacking up on each other at Calf. And that's their goal. Their first goal is destroy the Ultramarines. Their second goal, their real goal, is bring about the Ruined Storm. And this is essentially just the way that they're going about it. Well, as we covered in our Battle of Kalth series, the Word Bearers had slipped into the Kalth system sometime before the first open acts of war between the two legions. Among them was the Destiny's Hand, the battle barge of the Dark Apostle Erebus himself. And while the rest of the legion gathered for the oncoming surprise attack, he teleported down to Kalth's surface, arriving on the Satyric Plateau, located north of Numinous City, a site chosen as the best place to conduct the blasphemous chaotic ritual Erebus had been tasked to perform. It was a place that hummed with etheric energy, a place where the immaterium vectors aligned perfectly, and the barrier between real space and the other realm was particularly thin. That entire description makes me think of Stonehenge. You know how you like ever hear people talk about like how Stonehenge is just this weird place primed for magic?
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Like people talk about like
shit all the time.
Yeah. Or people talk about like ley lines meeting, like the pyramids are like anything like that.
And
yeah, yeah. So the Satyric Plateau just feels kind of like that area. Like that's the area that they're sent to at Kalth. It's the area where the magic is the strongest, in my mind anyway. Erebus was met by a Word Bearer's strike team that had already infiltrated Kalth, led by Assembler Zote. He was one of the dreaded demon-possessed word bearers known as the Gaul Vorbach. So if you guys remember back when we covered the Ishtvan 5 drop site massacre, the Gaul Vorbach were essentially word bearers that were already playing a little bit too fast and loose with their alliance with demons. And when Logar was struck down or almost struck down by Corvus, Korax, he essentially unleashed this like massive psychic scream and it unlocked the demons that were inside the Gaul Vorbach. So the Gaul Vorbach up to that point were Reagan with Pazuzu in them. And then after that point, they were Pazuzu has fully possessed Reagan and the end of the exorcist is playing out, but the priests are dead.
Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, and Mr. Hyde just took over.
Yeah, so the Gaul Vorbach at this point, as to where the Battle of Kalth has happened, they're essentially these half-demon word bearers. And if you want to have a 41st millennia analogy to these guys, these are the possessed. If you buy the possessed Space Marine kit, that's what the Gaul Vorbach are. The Gaul Vorbach were that originally, and now basically every Space Marine, Chaos Space Marine warband can use them. Assembler Zote's guys had brought down a work party of the Tezvar Kall, the reclusive family, a chaos cult that served the Word Bearer's Legion. In order to enact the ritual that would birth the Ruin Storm, the men of the call laid out a circle of polished black rocks on the plateau, each taken from the volcanic slopes of Ishtvan V and marked with blasphemous sigils. These summoning stones formed a perfect circle a kilometer in diameter, their latent chaotic power enough to make even those who carried them violently sick. Next, the men of the Zenvar call approached the summoning circle, each carrying other offerings harvested from the Ishtvan system. They marched in a procession, bearing along portable stasis flasks filled with murky, blood-stained fluids, each containing a progenoid gland and Jeed seed, components that had been harvested from the dead Legionis Astartes of the killing fields on Ishtvan 3 and Ishtvan 5, traitors and loyalists alike. The moment one of the call carried the flasks over the threshold of the summoning stones, they started to whimper or retch. Many passed out, while others suffered violent strokes and died, falling and smashing their flasks. However, it mattered not, for the sacrifices still fell inside the circle. Then, as the moon rose in perfect alignment, Erebus sent a voxlink message to the traitors in orbit. It was time for the next step in the ritual. It was then, all across Kalth and in the void above it, that the Word Bearers took their revenge against the Ultramarines and their insufferable Primarch. The ritual would come to an end, bringing about the Ruin Storm at the battle's final conclusion, as the Word Bearer's weapons overwhelmed the Viridian System's star. Its collapse sending out a shockwave of solar energy that effectively tore all life from Kalth and the rest of the system, adding the psychic shockwave of so much more death to the already pulsing ritual energies, leaving only those already underground or extremely lucky to continue fighting over the now dead world. And so again, if you guys want a deeper look, we did a three-part series on this.
I was going to say, so this is essentially the beginning of the end. This is when the Eye of Terra became the, is it the Cicatrix Maledictum? Or is this
no
the opening this of is, the Eye of Terra? Or
the Eye of Terra was Slaanesh's birth.
Right.
The Ruined Storm is essentially like a miniature Age of Strife.
Okay.
So in the Age of Strife, the warp storms around the galaxy got so bad that all human planets were cut off from each other. The Ruined Storm is Logar trying to remake those storms, essentially.
Okay.
He wants to cut off all of the sectors and all of the planets from each other so nobody can communicate with Terra, and so Terra can't communicate with anybody. And at the same time, all of the Space Marine Legions can't communicate with each other, except for the Traitors. The Traitors get a free pass because the Traitors are using the Ruined Storm essentially to
get
communicate and travel.
And, yeah.
Right. I mean, Chaos is still, as I mentioned before, Chaos is still kind of fucking with them, but it's more like, you know, that prank
so it's
show.
Like a, not as bad
it's
as
a little
it.
Less like Slaughter and a little bit more like that pranked show.
Yeah. So not as bad as the Cicatrix Maledictum, but still bad. Age of Strife bad.
Kind of
shorter, smaller, not
like
smaller
a
scale,
reflection.
But shorter. Time. Okay.
Yeah. It lasts, well, as far as we know, because again, we don't really know. I guess we do know. The Cicatrix Maledictum has been around for like, what, 200 years at this point in lore?
I believe
but
so,
yeah. It's kind of like if the Cicatrix Maledictum was the earthquake, the Ruined Storm was the foreshock.
Mm.
So it was like the little shock that happened before the actual like big split. The Ruined Storm brought about the next phase of the heresy, which was called the Age of Darkness, and during the following years it would continue to grow in size and potency, dragging an ever-growing list of regions, sectors, and domains into the darkness following the destruction of Kalth. It was continually fueled by the psychic energies and backlashes released into the Immaterium by the misery of Logar's coming Shadow Crusade. Unlike the Cicatrix Maledictum, which has very efficiently cut the galaxy in half, the Ruined Storm acted more to isolate any loyalist legion and their attendant forces from one another, almost like a mini Age of Strife. We just talked about that. Most Legionist Astartes forces, not under direct and personal command of their Primarchs, were forced to operate on their own for extended periods of time. In many cases, these isolated chapters and commands operated under these conditions for the entirety of the heresy, continuing to fight alone and without Imperial support or communication. In some cases, maybe even believing they were all that was left of the Imperium. So the Cicatrix Maledictum basically split the galaxy in half, but you know it's there. So you know if you're in the dark side of it, you know if you're in the dark Imperium, you're not going to be able to communicate very easily outside of the dark Imperium, but you still know that the Imperium is there. In this case of the Ruined Storm, people were so effectively cut off. They were cut off in like smaller pockets. It was like the Cicatrix Maledictum is building a wall to keep one side separated from the other. The Ruined Storm was locking everybody in a room in a mansion. Does that kind of work a little bit better as an analogy,
yeah.
I guess?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So some of these groups of Astartes were so isolated that they thought they were it. They thought everybody else in the Imperium was dead. They thought that their command of like 500 guys fighting back to back, they're like, this is it, last stand. And that happened over and over and over again. It wasn't just one group, it was hundreds of groups. As we mentioned a few times in the last several episodes, loyalist elements of the traitor legions became just as cut off, becoming black shields. So if you were a loyalist that was in a traitor legion, somehow the Chaos Gods knew and they would cut you off. And that was part of what led to those legions, those elements of those legions, joining up with loyalists and becoming what was known as Black Shields, at least one of the ways that the word Black Shield is used. While traitorous elements of the loyalists were able to slip away through the warp, becoming Black Shields, but for the other side. But it also had a more unsettling effect because a lot of stuff that came out of it was born of the powers of the Dark Gods. Whereas most of this had existed within just the confines of the warp before, disrupting the technological side that relied on the warp to operate, like astropathic communication and faster than light warp travel, as we've talked about in the past, going through the warp, you can be waylaid by warp creatures, by powers in the warp. And the Imperium knew that. They didn't necessarily see them as demons, but they knew that there was shit in the warp that would attack you. They knew that there was stuff in the warp that could disrupt astropathic communications, but that shit had never come out of the warp. Now it's bleeding through into real space all over the place because of the ruin storm, unleashing the raw substance of the immaterium, which tainted the void itself with coiling etheric tendrils and kaleidoscopic shifts of undefinable colors. From observers on the surfaces of many worlds, the stars appeared to have become swallowed by the void entirely, while in others, the night skies became a canvas on which the scenes ripped directly from ancient texts describing various hells played out endlessly. Well, imagine looking up into the sky and seeing either all of the stars wink out one by one, or just like the Book of Revelation play out over and over again in the clouds in, you know, eight glorious 8K resolution. The biggest screen you've ever seen playing the most horrendous movie you don't want to watch.
God, so gnarly, like just the idea of how the scale of this, like how it would just completely screw with the human mind, like, and how iron-willed you have to be just to deal with, just to live
to survive
in this universe. Yeah, I mean, people obviously go crazy and shit all the time, but like, right. I don't know, just seems a bit much.
It's 28 days later is happening. while 30 days of night is happening. While Bird Box is happening.
Right.
And you're just like, well, fuck, what do I do? Like, I guess I'll just stay in my room and hope for the best.
Yep.
Don't go outside. Don't talk to anybody. Like,
yeah, don't look
at anything. Don't look up. Yeah. On the worst afflicted of these worlds, nightmares were given flesh and stalked the land, as the veil between the immaterium and the real space had been stretched past its breaking point. The first such cases happening on Kalth during the battle itself, as these entities, known now as demons, came spewing forth to attack the Ultramarines. But this was far from the only case, as many often isolated detachments of Loyalist Space Marines would also have their first encounters with such abominations across several key war zones, some of which weren't even aware that the Great Crusade had ended and they were now firmly in the grips of a new conflict. So there were Space Marines that had no idea anything happened. They're just on whatever battlefield they had been stationed to, and suddenly there's a bunch of fucking bloodthirsters charging at them. And they don't know. They have no fucking clue. There's nothing in their training that's prepared them for this. These creatures, which at first the savants and xenobiologists attempted to quantify, violated the secular views of the Imperium and the Imperial truth. By 010.M31, the Imperium of Man that had once stood before the secular vision of the Emperor had crumbled and was no more. The fires of civil war consumed the galaxy on hundreds of major fronts, while darker shadow wars raged in the places that seemed to be far beyond the touch of any central conflict. So it didn't matter where you were. I think you just kind of brought this up eloquently. This is a time where it doesn't fucking matter where you are. Everything's a shit show.
Is this also like the first time a lot of Space Marines are seeing demons? Like, I know some legions have already fought demons, but is this, or is this the first time?
Some legionaries have fought demons. This is the first time where the legions like are fighting scale. Demons. Yeah. So there's, you know, Gavriel Loken fought a demon very early, even before Horus fell on Davin. And you know, his essentially the warriors with him also fought it. So there's like, I would say before the bloodthirsters burst forth on Kalth and charged the Ultramarines in mass, there were probably 55 Astartes in total who had ever encountered a demon.
Yeah.
And maybe two Primarchs. Like, the Primarchs didn't even really know. This is the argument that I've had in the past, that this is the big flaw in the Emperor's plan from the beginning.
Yeah,
he kept so many of the Primarchs, yeah, and their legions locked away after the Council of Nicaea. he didn't tell any of them that any of this shit was there. And I get that it was because he was trying to work towards a scenario where they would never have to deal with it. But like, I mean, imagine being in a situation where you're asked to do a job in hostile territory and you're not given all the information. That doesn't happen. I thought I had a really good strong stance until I started talking.
Yeah,
I'm not like, gonna lie. Well,
I mean,
but like, I mean, yeah, it's that idea. It's you're being asked to do a job, but you're not being given the entire, which, you know, it's repeated time and again. It's kind of like the flaw in this system that life exists in at times, as we're like, you're never given enough.
He treated it like on a need to know basis, but in this case, everyone needed to know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. It was like, because they don't. Yeah.
Yeah. Because something like this could have happened at the drop of a hat. I mean, yeah, Logar did it. But if it wasn't Logar, it was going to be somebody else. And I guess kind of to your point, maybe there were more Space Marines that had dealt with it because there had been times where the Geller fields had like failed and shit had like come in. But the difference is, I feel like, and maybe this is just like, as the 41st millennia has become the new thing, demons have solidified more into like the shapes that we identify as, because I feel like things breaking through the Geller field is a little bit more like, ow, this angry jellyfish is attacking me. It's a bloodthirster, but you just see it as a weird tentacled thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like a demon.
You almost feel like it's a nightmare, right? Like, because everything that you just did, like the blood on your chainsword is going to go away the second you leave the warp.
Yeah. As soon as you're out of the Geller field, or as soon as your Geller field comes back online, or as soon as you do that emergency leave out of the warp, none of that shit's gonna come with you. Yeah, exactly.
So you're like, did that really just happen?
Yeah. I mean, I know Space Marine Bob is dead, but
did he just trip and fall? step Space Marine, no.
No, it's a World War Z when the biologist trips and shoots himself in the head. Did Bob just trip and shoot himself in the head?
Sure did.
Told him not to keep his finger on the trigger.
Like, damn, that sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah, No, I was just going to say that scene was so, I don't even know. I don't even have words for it. It was just.
So there's definitely, having read the book and having watched the movie, they're definitely very different. They're both good. Sure. They're both good for their own reasons.
I tried reading the book, man. The book was like way too, not politically driven. It's abstract. But like, yeah,
it's really abstract because it's not a continuous story. It's different people's like micro experiences.
Yeah. Which I can't follow that shit, dude. Like I can't follow short stories. I need a big picture and I need a linear story. So like kind of like the Witcher books where like the Witcher books jumps back and forth in time and different points of the story. I'm just like, I can't follow this shit, dude.
I have no idea what's going on anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
I need to take notes to read this piece of fiction.
I'm the fucking biologist that trips and falls and shoots himself in the face whenever I try to read a book. Every time I pick up a book, I trip a fall and I smash that book into my face.
And that's knowledge, buddy.
Yeah.
Back on the throne world, the War Council of Terra was blinded by the ruined storm and sought any means to gauge the true scope of the unfolding apocalyptic disaster. They no longer had the astropathic means to measure the disposition of Horus or even confirm who the War Master's allies were. The message they did send were either being swallowed in the howling cacophony of the warp or being corrupted and distorted into insidious new messages. It's kind of like we talked, Horus intercepted the message from the Emperor to Leman Russ and twisted it to make it seem like the Emperor was telling Leman Russ to kill the Thousand Sons. The warp's now doing that to just random messages. Their only means of confirming the status and allegiance of the now scattered worlds of the Imperium would be to dispatch envoys and agents, just like in the days of old. It all had to be done in person, even as the Council knew that such a hazardous mission would be the death of thousands of loyal and devoted servants of Terra. It would prove almost impossible for the Imperial historians and savants to piece together any coherent picture of all of the Legionis Astartes during the ruined storm. As for every world that burned in the planet-wide grip of open warfare, an uncountable number of smaller scale but just as bitter wars were being fought all over. As the end of the Great Crusade slowly gave way to the heresy in full, many of the legions that had been operating as large forces under direct command of their primarchs, or with only small contingents operating independently following long-established rules, started to become more and more cut off. With the expansion of the Ruined Storm came the Age of Darkness, and many of these mighty hosts became increasingly fragmented. While each Primarch did maintain direct command of a core of their legion, they found it necessary to dispatch ever more subcommands out across the galaxy, either in pursuit of the traitors or to secure other strategic or loyalist logistical goals. The storm didn't show any signs of slowing, only seeming to grow ever greater, isolating more regions from the greater Imperium. This acted to turn many such detachments into independent commands in all but name, their leaders given total authority to conduct their own wars in fighting the greater enemies of the Imperium. These forces varied in scale from subcompanies to battalions or chapters, and many had been originally dispatched against vital targets in surgical strikes. Be those targets key enemy warlords or civilian leaders in key positions within the traitor's power balance, many of these attacks being little more than callous murders and brutal assassinations. Even further, Astarte's kill teams and strike forces were capable of reaching and dispatching targets a more conventional and larger Astarte's force could not engage. With no way to verify targets or seek higher commands, though, this meant that no human commander, and sometimes Astarte's, or high administrator was safe from the executioner's axe. And these guys were essentially just, they may have been given a list of targets, and once those targets were gone, they're like, well, I guess we just kind of target people that are acting the same way.
Yeah, it almost kind of reminds me of that is it Bolter and Chainsword episode of like that new Cadian troop that had to deliver a letter from the message bunker to
and by
another.
The time they yeah and by the time he finally gets there it doesn't matter anymore. Yeah, exactly. Dude, that was a brutal episode with all the Tyranids.
That was.
Yeah, and it's you know, and what's happening here is these kill teams, because essentially that's what they are. They're strike forces and kill teams. Sometimes they're as large as a chapter, but most of the time you're not dealing with a large force, or you were dealing with a large force. That large force gets whittled down. You know, you've got six planets in a subsector that you have to deal with, and none of them are in the same system. They're all in separate systems. You send your squads out, you know, say you're the commander and you send your four lieutenants out to do four different jobs. Those lieutenants get to the areas that they're supposed to deal with, and they send their sergeants out to do jobs. Those sergeants then can't get in contact with the lieutenants, or those lieutenants can't get in contact with the captain, or whatever happens. The war moves on and you get this group of maybe 200 Marines under a sergeant or 100 Marines under a sergeant. And all they know is that they're supposed to take out anybody who is a demagogue, you know, somebody who's speaking about religion and like pushing religion. That's all they know. They're supposed to take out this target. That was their order. Their order was, there's this crazy preacher on this planet and he's just going on and on and on and you have to take him out. So they take him out, but then a preacher rises up in support of the emperor. And they're like, well, our last orders were to take out the preacher, so I guess we have to take this one out too. And then they take that guy out, you know, and then like where does it, they don't, the sergeants essentially, like these independent kill teams basically don't really know what to do. And in some cases they go, oh, well, you know, Sergeant Sebastian is being too bloodthirsty, so do we take Sergeant Sebastian out? Like,
yeah, it's just complete mayhem.
They start playing all of these little, by necessity, or not by necessity, by reaction, they start having very, very small scale, independent personal wars, essentially. In other cases, a loyalist force would pledge themselves to defend individual worlds against the traitors, particularly if they had found themselves stranded by the Ruin Storm. Well, you know, you're stranded on a planet. This is now the planet that I protect. Like, I don't know what else to do. I guess I'm stuck here. I guess this is what we're doing, or this is the system we're protecting. Other Legionis Astartes ranged for thousands of light years across the galaxy, braving the perils of the storm-wrecked warp in an effort to engage the enemy wherever they could be found. You had guys bloodthirstily chasing down traitors. Not only does all of this echo what is to come in the chapter organization and how the Imperium uses the Astartes in the 41st millennium, but a lot of the origins of those early chapters' specific cultures also come from this time. So if you think about some of the earliest chapters and the way they act, it comes from the fact that those groups of people that became the center of those chapters were engaged in this form of warfare during the heresy. And the way that the Imperium in the 41st millennia deals with Space Marine chapters, this is what they do. They send Space Marine chapters in small groups for surgical strikes. They don't use them as an overwhelming army anymore. All of that organizational stuff really stems from this conflict. It's also a great place to start when you're looking at making your own lore. Or if you are like me and you want to pick out an existing chapter that might be a bit more obscure or have origins that stem back to the Heresy era. The Ashen Claws specifically being a chapter that came from this era. They were not a chapter created with a founding. They are a chapter that left the Raven Guard during the Heresy. The bulk of the First Legion Dark Angels had been engaged against the Night Lords for much of this period of time. In the aftermath of the Lion's victory over the traitor Primarch Conrad Cruz at Tuscaloosa, they dispatched numerous strike forces across the Eastern Galaxy to hunt down their splintered foes. Don't worry, we'll get back into more detail about this event when we cover Conrad Cruz in detail in a coming episode. Many Dark Angels never returned, pursuing their own missions across the Ultima Segmenta and beyond. Some of these dispatched forces encountered other similarly isolated or orphaned Legionis Astartes groups, finding common cause with some and fighting others to the death, the ruined storm making it impossible for them to return home or to receive new orders. While the majority of the 9th Legion Blood Angels were marooned in the Cygnus Cluster and cut off from communication with their Legion homeworld of Baal. We mentioned the Cygnus Cluster earlier in the episode. That event wrapped up right around the time the Ruined Storm exploded. Actually, a little bit after the Ruined Storm exploded. So as they're trying to leave the Cygnus Cluster, they just can't get out because of the Ruined Storm. In fact, the fate of the Blood Angels would remain largely a mystery until the Legion returned to the broader Imperium in 10.M31. The Blood Angels are just missing from Imperial record for 2 years. Everybody assumes that they're gone and dead, or at least the majority of them are gone and dead. While the majority of the Blood Angels had followed the War Master's order to muster in the Nar-Tabada system and then follow their Primarch into the Cygnus Cluster, several thousand had never arrived. Some had been serving as Lamenti honor guardians watching over silent battlefields where the Legion had shed its blood, while others simply never reached Narabata. Their vessels cast far and wide upon the tides of the warp as the ruined storm brewed. It was only later that news of their survival began to filter out, and only then very slowly thanks to the ruined storm. For a period of almost 500 standard years, as an example, many of those lost and scattered Blood Angels forces who survived their misjumps to Narabata had every reason to believe themselves orphans and the last remaining survivors of their Legion. So there was whole companies that just had no fucking idea anything had happened for 500 standard years. So we're talking, these guys showed back up into the Imperium after the scouring, after the Reformation, like insane.
Yeah, for sure, dude. That. It's just,
and for the entire time, they thought they were it. They're like, we're the last survivors of the Imperium. Like, we're it.
500 years, God.
10,000 years will give you such a crick in the neck. Lastly, the 13th Legion Ultramarines were also greatly affected by the Ruin Storm, as obviously the bulk of the Legion had mustered at Kalth. So they were kind of the sacrifice that caused the damn thing. Obviously, they were affected. Those who survived spent the majority of 007.M31 and 008.M31 engaged in a bitter war to repulse the so-called Shadow Crusade of the Primarchs Angron and Logar. Still other Legion detachments were stationed elsewhere, on linchpin worlds such as Molech and serving in the conquistador fleets of the rogue trader militants. Furthermore, there are likely to have been ultramarine units that had not arrived at Kalth when the Word Bearer's betrayal struck, coming to the world only in its aftermath, becoming then cut off from their commands themselves only to operate as independent autonomous forces until they reestablish contact with their chain of command. So These are guys that are getting late to the party at Calth and finding nothing, not even communication from the world. Because, you know, after the Battle of Calth, there's this whole underground war that happens for several years. Those guys aren't communicating with anybody in the void because they don't. They don't have a way to. There's no reestablishment. So these dudes are blipping in, being like, what the fuck happened here? There's no one here. There's no honor guard. There's no message beacon. There's nothing. And then they just go, well, I guess we'll go do the next thing. And then they just go to the next thing until somebody does get in contact with them. The ruin storm eventually grew so strong and covered so much of the galaxy that Primarch Reboot Gilliman of the Ultramarines feared that the throne world of Terra itself was lost to the loyalists. To maintain the power of the Imperium and the ideals of the Emperor of Mankind in the region now cut off from Terra's control, Gilliman proceeded to create his own auxiliary imperial state, the Imperium Secundus. Only through the use of a pre-imperial Xenos biotechnological artifact called the Pharos were the loyalists of the Imperium Secundus able to navigate through the greater warp storms, using it like a much weaker version of the later Astronomicon to regroup on the Ultramarines' homeworld of McCraig. And we kind of talked about that with the Battle of Fall. When the Imperial Fists leave the Battle of Fall, they can't find Terra, but they can find the Pharos and they get to McCraig. The Imperium Secundus, as much as it kind of gets maligned and like meme shit on, ends up being one of those things that kind of helped the Imperium survive in a weird way. This is a really big, you know, you brought this up earlier. This is a huge reflection of what's currently happening. And it's here with the galaxy sundered in twain that we will wrap up our coverage of the first third of the Horus Heresy, a time of Imperial history, much like that of the era Indominus, where it seems as if two Imperiums rule, each believing that the other is lost and that they are themselves the sole survivors of humanity's greatest potential.
I didn't realize that, but yeah, that is very similar to what's going on right now after the Cicatrix Maledictum.
It's a huge reflection.
Huh.
Right? It's cool. I'm glad that you asked that question early on, because I was like, he's hitting on it. He's hearing it. He's picking up.
Yeah,
he's seeing what the ruin storm is doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Okay. Well, you know, fucking Ultramarines.
There you go.
Always got to save the day.
And we'll get there. We'll talk about Imperius Secundus soon.
Secundus.
As I mentioned.
Sorry. That's all I heard.
As I mentioned up top, we will be taking a few episodes to cover some other lore and topics as we regroup and plan out our next mini-series tackling the lore of the Horus Heresy. One of these upcoming topics will be a Loris Obscurus topic focused on the great cryptid of the American West, the Jackalope.
Yeah.
Listeners, as of the release of this episode, you have a few weeks to reach out to us and get us either your spooky stories, or if you want, you can join us on our Discord community to take a look at our SCP-inspired Ordo Obscurus report template and submit your own Ordo Obscurus report. Want to get into contact with us about the show? Hit us up on email at underthehiveofmadness@gmail.com.
And as Ryan just mentioned, you can also join our community on Discord. Over there, we talk about lore, hobby, and tactics of Warhammer 40K. You can also pitch us any ideas or ask us any questions, share your own lore with our awesome community, or find writing prompts or other ways to get involved in our little corner of homebrew 40K lore. Plus, we have channels dedicated to other topics such as Warhammer Fantasy Battle, Age of Sigmar, Magic the Gathering, role-playing games, video games, and much more. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, or at our website, underthehiveofmadness.com. Spelling and links are in the show notes.
You can also help the podcast grow by liking and reviewing us wherever you get your podcast fix. Our home is here on Spotify, but you can find us on Audible, Apple Podcasts, CastBox, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Radio Public, and more. Support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/underthehiveofmadness. All Patreon members get access to a video podcast so you can see our beautiful faces with minimal editing, so you can hear all of the blunders we make, like me reading that shit out of order. All Patreon levels also get access to our quarterly painting contest. Plus, we've started to do monthly giveaways. So if any of that stuff strikes your fancy, head on over and check it out. You gotta love Misfit Alley, your center for all things nutty and debaucherous. Come on down and check out the never-ending Carnival of Mischief. I gotta admit, Marky, it's pretty awesome that you can get this here rooftop rat curry and then walk right across the street and get four handguns and, is that a whip? I think that's a whip. I like that. I think I'm a whip guy. You think I'm a whip guy now?
I think I'd settle for the gun and the whip over rooftop rat. It just seems like...
Oh, come on, this curry is amazing. You should try it.
I don't know, man. I feel like it's overcooked.
It's the Balter. The Balter powder really cuts the acidity. Really
takes the edge off.
We are the cascade of sound designed to blow out your dad's favorite speakers. The screaming vengeance of truth. 665.66 UHMR Chemrat Radio. Reminding all of you Chemrats, Hive Mice, and Sump Ghoulies to keep those dials fixed right here. Same ratty frequency for a dose of the same ratty-ass attitude.
In the shadows they skulk, with dread they loom, four-armed emperors, heralding impending doom. Beware their embrace in the Frost Hollow's tomb.
Motherfuckers.
All you fucking mothers.
All you fucking... fucking... Don't listen to Marky read a book.
Call it learning the hard way.